Leadership and Coaching, in partnership with Mobius Executive Leadership, are proud to present Conversations with Masters, a series of conversations with key thought leaders in executive coaching and organizational intervention. Session 7, Neuroscience of Leadership and Coaching, with Janet Crawford.
Coaches and OD professionals, we generally focus our work on our clients' thoughts, emotions, senses, and actions. But what we and our clients often are missing is an understanding of how the underlying mechanisms of the human brain and nervous system affect or even produce those thoughts, emotions, sensations, and actions. As you'll learn in today's call, recent discoveries in the field of neuroscience has a great deal to offer us and our clients. Welcome, everyone, to the fourth session of Conversations with Masters series brought to you by Integral Leadership and Coaching and Mobius Executive Leadership. We're pleased and honored to bring you some of the very best practitioners in the world of integrative learning and leadership. My name is Charles Feltman, and I'm a senior executive coach for Integral Leadership and Coaching, and I'll serve as your moderator for today's call. In this session, I am thrilled to host Janet Crawford, who will be speaking with us about what neuroscience can offer to the fields of coaching and organizational development work. I've known Janet for almost a decade now, and I'm always learning something from her. That's probably because she's always learning herself. She's always kind of out in the forefront of various fields, trying to figure out what's going on and then bringing what she's learning back into her practice. She's a graduate of both UC Berkeley and Stanford Universities. And early in her career, she worked for the EPA as an environmental scientist. Over the years, her focus has shifted to OD work and eventually coaching. Today, Janet is a highly respected executive coach who works with top corporate leaders, teams, and sometimes entire organizations. But she has never lost her interest in the practical application of scientific research and discovery. Welcome, Janet. It's great to have you here today.
It's great to be here, Charles. Thank you for that introduction. Charles just covered a lot about who I am, and I'll give you just another word of how I transitioned from being an environmental scientist into the work that I do today. As Charles said, as coaches and as leadership development and OD professionals, we're really here tasked with understanding why people behave the way they do, why organizations do the things that they do, and how we can make leaders and organizations more effective. I transitioned out of environmental science because at one point during my career, I realized that my passion was really not around science so much as it was around understanding the human system that I was working with. I was getting promoted fairly rapidly in the organization, and I couldn't figure out why, because I knew I wasn't the best scientist in the mix. And in a blinding flash of the obvious at one point, I realized that what I really love to do is the human aspect of things. And part of that human aspect was trying to make sense of the behaviors that I was seeing. Behaviors that weren't necessarily logical, and yet the people that were producing those behaviors, predominantly scientists, the people that I was working with, prized at least the belief about themselves that they were logical human beings. So coming from a scientific perspective, I started looking about a decade ago for what out there in the world of science, in the world of neuroscience, might start to explain some of the behaviors that I was seeing within organizations. Here's where the caveat that Charles mentioned comes in. So I've been doing this work, coaching leadership development, for about 15 years. I've been working to integrate information from neuroscience into leadership and coaching for over a decade. When I started doing this, there was almost nobody else out there engaged in that inquiry. And now, as a lot of you probably know, it's very popular. I get frequent emails almost on a daily basis from somebody who is looking into some aspect of leadership and coaching with relationship to neuroscience. And I'm starting to notice a little bit of a disturbing phenomenon, which is that there's a lot of misquoting of science going on. And a lot of people who are kind of jumping on the scientific bandwagon without fully understanding the conversation that they're engaging in. So what I want to say about that is that science is just one way of knowing. It's not the only way of knowing, but it happens to be a way of knowing that our culture really privileges. And so if I can say this is scientifically proven, it somehow jumps through a bunch of hoops in terms of credibility. So I'm much more credible if I can put science behind my claims than if I can't in this culture. That's great if, in fact, what I'm talking about has been scientifically proven. The bad news is that most of the stuff that we're talking about in neuroscience is really in its infancy. We're just starting to get the technologies at a widespread level cheap enough that we can do a lot of large-scale studies on the human brain. So a lot of what you see in the popular press is several translations down the chain of a small study that was conducted. It might have been 10 or 15 graduate students. They may have been all male. They may have been all between the ages of 22 and 28. You don't know the quality of the data, and then it's been translated by non-scientists and appears in a newspaper, and then it gets quoted by somebody who's in the coaching field. So what I'm going to attempt to do with the information that I give you is two things. One is to have it be information that is fairly well established within the literature at this point. And the other is to qualify a difference between what's science and what's been proven by science and what's a hypothesis that results from that scientific data. And most of what we're seeing in the coaching and leadership world is hypothesis that comes from a set of scientific data, which is fine, but it's important to make that distinction. So anything that you'd want to add to that, Charles?
I think that's a great kind of explanation of, or a great jumping off point, because, like you said, there are a lot of hypotheses out there that sound really good and that actually kind of blend nicely with some of the ideas we have about how people change and learn and develop, but not all of them necessarily, like you're saying, are accurate.
Yeah, and it becomes very alluring if you have a particular viewpoint or worldview that you found to be very useful in your work as a coach or a leadership development professional, and you find some piece or tidbit of science that seems to support it, to make that link and to overstate the link. And I think it's fine just to say, here's something that I saw in the scientific literature that seems to support the hypothesis that I have. And that would be the accurate way of stating it. The other thing that I would say is that there's a lot of stuff out there, popular movies such as What the Bleep, The Secret, all of that. And we may talk about some of that during the call, where it's partially supported by science and partially not supported by science. So it's very easy to kind of blur the boundary.
That said, Janet, I think that you know, I've listened to you and worked with you for a while, and I know that there is a whole lot that you do know and can address that is well supported by scientific research that's really valuable for coaching, for OD work, for leadership development. So maybe we should just kind of dive into the fundamentals here, and let's go.
So the first thing that I want to talk about, and this may actually, for many of the people on the call, since I don't know what the range of backgrounds are, this may be old hat for some of you and new for others. But I want to start with this so that we all have a fundamental basis for understanding the human brain. So the human brain is really not one brain. It's really more like three brains. And the human brain, humans actually have a triune brain, tri meaning three, une meaning one in Latin, so the three-in-one brain. The levels of the brain follow roughly the levels of evolution. So at the very bottom level of the brain, the most basic brain that we have, sometimes referred to as the reptilian brain or the brain stem, is responsible for very basic survival. Keeps us breathing, keeps our heart beating. It's the one that's responsible for base level sexual reproduction, essentially anything that keeps our genes alive on the planet, that's being covered by the reptilian level of the brain. When we move up one level from that, there's a whole set of structures that are distinct from the reptilian system called the limbic system. Now, reptiles don't have a limbic system, so you can see how this starts to mirror the evolutionary ladder. But all mammals do have limbic systems, and the higher the level of the mammal, the larger the limbic system becomes. And what the limbic system is responsible for is consolidating memory and emotion. So we primarily associate the limbic system with emotion. And if you can think about snakes and lizards, they're not very emotional creatures. They're not emotional at all. In fact, a lot of snakes will eat their young as soon as they're born. They don't have any maternal feeling at all about their offspring. Mammals, on the other hand, most of their offspring rely on them after they're born for quite some time until they become competent in the world. And we see a kind of emotional bonding between the members of the species. And in fact, cross species, and this is why we prefer cats and dogs as pets, because they have an emotional sense to them. So that's the emotional level of the brain. Something that's interesting about that emotional or limbic level of the brain is that it doesn't distinguish between what's real and what's imagined. And this is very important. So we're going to move up one level from that to the most recent part of the brain, and that's the neocortex. And the neocortex is really what distinguishes humans from the rest of the animals on the planet. There are a few other primates that have a relatively evolved neocortex, but human beings are really the only ones that have a predominantly huge neocortex. So what the neocortex is responsible for is, and this is where that right-left, right-brain, left-brain distinction comes in, which has many of you may be familiar with, and what you need to know is that's been largely disproven. There are some loose correlations that map to left and right, and I don't want to get into the left-right-brain controversy right now, but know that roughly, the left side of the brain is more analytical and sequential in its functioning. The right side of the brain is more quote-unquote creative or non-sequential in its thinking. The left side of the brain has more language functioning. The right side of the brain has more nonverbal functioning. So there's some rough delineation between the two sides of the brain. But what we can say about the neocortex is that's the part of the brain that's responsible for future thinking. It's the part of the brain that takes in all of the data, with the exception of smell, that goes directly to the emotional center. But all the other data goes directly into the neocortex, various parts of the neocortex, for processing. And it's the neocortex where all of the higher level thinking and analysis of things take place. In particular, the very front part of the neocortex, which lies right behind your forehead, there's a structure called the prefrontal cortex, which is particularly important. And I'm going to give you a list of things that the prefrontal cortex does. I'll say them slowly in case you want to write it down. So strategy, number one, any kind of forward thinking. Think about human beings. We can sit down together, talk about an idea, talk about something that does not exist today, and make it happen a day from now or a week from now or a year from now. There's no other animal that does that, that plans out a future that's different from the one today and then analyzes a pathway to get there. So number two, morality. Don't think I need to say anything more about that one. Number three, response flexibility, or another way of putting that is the ability to choose our emotional response. Number four, empathy. Number five, intuition. Number six, fear moderation, the ability to see something or experience something scary and self-soothe or choose whether or not we should react to that fear stimulus. Let's see, on seven, emotional balance. And then the last one, a lot of the aspects of effective communication, effective coordination of communication take place in the prefrontal cortex. So you can see that that part of the brain is particularly important. If we had organizations and leaders that were filled with healthy prefrontal cortexes and leaders that were coming from the place of a healthy prefrontal cortex, we'd have pretty functional behavior in our organizations and in our society. Many of the breakdowns that we experience, I think, are the result of prefrontal cortexes that aren't functioning the way or functioning optimally. So I'm going to back up and give you one more piece of information and then turn it back to Charles and then perhaps take some questions. So those are the three levels of the brain. We've got the reptilian system, the limbic system, the neocortex, and then as part of the neocortex, you have the prefrontal cortex. I'm going to back up one level to the limbic system, which is that middle section of the brain that's responsible for emotion. The limbic system has something called the amygdala, which many of you are probably, if not all of you, are probably familiar with. It's A-M-Y-G-D-A-L-A, for those of you who have not seen that word. And the amygdala, which is about the size of an almond or your thumbnail, the job of the amygdala is to determine how much danger there is in your environment. And if it senses that the environment is dangerous, it's going to turn control of your brain over to the reptilian system. So the reptilian system, remember, is base level survival. And so when things get too dangerous, the reptilian brain can take over and cause the fight, flight, or freeze response. This makes sense because when you're in a primitive environment and there's a danger, if the saber-toothed tiger has jumped on you, you want to fight. You don't want to think about your response. If there's a chance to run away from it, you want to run. You don't want to think about how you respond to that. So where survival is at stake, you have a pre-program in your head that says running away or fighting or getting as small and inconsequential as possible so that the prey doesn't see you are the appropriate responses to that situation. Now, the problem that we encounter in modern-day life is that most of the triggers for the amygdala, most of the things that we code as danger, are no longer survival-level dangers, yet we continue to respond to them with this, it's called an amygdala hijack. We continue to respond by moving into the reptilian brain. So one of the tasks of leadership and one of the tasks of leadership coaching is how do you create an environment within organizations that's safe for the people that live there and work there so that the amygdala is kept largely calm and the part of the brain that we want to have available, which is the prefrontal cortex and the neocortex and the limbic system, that those parts of the brain are playing nice together and fully active. Because when those higher parts of the brain are fully active, we get high-quality work and high-quality communication. When we reroute to the reptilian brain, we get breakdown. So I'm going to stop there for a moment because that's a lot of information if it's new information for you and see if there are any questions or comments.
Yeah, why don't we, if you can, see if there are questions. And in the meantime, I'd like to just ask you one question regarding what you said about the limbic system not knowing the difference between what is real and what is imagined and the effect that has on this whole amygdala hijack response.
That's a fascinating one because we can have an amygdala hijack. We can divert attention from the prefrontal cortex by things that aren't actually real. So, for example, if I have a pervasive worry, that worry warms up my prefrontal cortex. Whether or not my worry is based in reality, it doesn't matter. It's still affecting my prefrontal cortex and starting to move me into an amygdala response. The more warmed up my amygdala is, the less additional warming it will take for it to hijack. So I might be carrying around a whole lot of worry about something, and then something fairly minor happens in my environment, and I trigger. So this one way this connects back to leadership is when leaders aren't listening to what's happening in their organizations, and they're allowing rumors to circulate, or let's say that there's some economic uncertainty, not that that might be happening, and nobody's talking about it. And there are rumors flying around about there might be layoffs or there might be reorganizations, and we're not really sure what's going to happen here. And that's not getting addressed by leadership because they're too busy focusing on other things. The quality of work in the organization will start to take a dive because people in the organization are diverting their brain from the part of the brain that can do the effective work into the lower parts of the brain that are more concerned with survival.
Yeah. So that's an area then that in terms of coaching, one of the things we can do is help our clients recognize that, the leaders recognize that, and recognize also probably their own potential for imagined threat.
Right.
What imagined threats do they worry about that warm up their amygdalas to the point where it can be triggered easily?
Yeah, and it's paying attention to the mood of the organization is vitally important, so that the mood that's created is calming to the amygdala. The mood that's created is one that doesn't lead to those kind of out in the future projections of horrible things happening. Because, by the way, our brain is pre-programmed to project out, to project futures. That's a function of being human and having a prefrontal cortex, is that we're constantly stepping out into the future and imagining what's going to happen next. And one of the leader's tasks is to make sure that what people are imagining happening next is actually functional, as opposed to something that's going to get in the way.
So let's check and see if there are any questions in the queue.
Thank you. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press the number 7 or letter Q on your telephone keypad at this time. Questions will be taken in the order that they are received. If at any point your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing 7. If you are using a speakerphone, we ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question or a comment, please press the number 7 or letter Q on your telephone keypad at this time. Our first question comes from Sylvina Coloni. Please state your question.
Yes, hi there, Charles and Janet, and hello to everyone else. I'm just curious around any issues with regard to gender differences and differences in brain in terms of responses, and in particular to this notion of fight, flight, or fright. I had read an article that suggested that, you know, how normally we say, well, people become stressed and men in response to stress may have heart attacks, whereas potentially women in response to stress actually go out and talk or, you know, set up some sort of network where they chat to someone else. Whereas, so that the usual view that flight, flight or fright is the way that we as humans respond to stress may actually be slightly different from women, and therefore some of the research or the expectations around stress and heart attack, etc., may no longer be entirely appropriate. I'm just wondering if you could comment or whether you have any insights on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to preface this by saying that I could have an all-day call on gender differences that would be tons of fun, so I'm going to rein myself in a little bit. And I intentionally did not mention that one just for the sake of time, but I will address it. First of all, it's fight, flight, and freeze are the three. And the fourth one has been dubbed, and it just went out of my head for a second. It'll come back.
Tend and befriend.
Thank you. Tend and befriend. To have these mnemonics for things. So the tend and befriend response was something that was noticed in a lab, I believe, at UCLA. And it's being studied right now, and it seems to be substantiated. I wouldn't necessarily go so far as to make the distinction between this is why men have heart attacks and women go out and talk. But what is being noticed is that women seem to, not in all circumstances, but in some circumstances, have a release of oxytocin, which is a neurotransmitter. And oxytocin causes bonding. So under stress, women can sometimes release oxytocin, which makes them want to go out and seek other people to bond with. And they typically will go seek other women to bond with. and talk about what's happening. And so this is a methodology for dealing with stress. It makes sense because if you are trying to defend against a predator or an invader to the village or whatever, if you go and you bond with other people and you have a set of people that you can trust to respond to that threat, you're in a stronger position. And women's, in terms of our evolution, have been in different social settings than men. Men are more frequently out on the hunt and in more exposed environments. So the methodology that they might choose to face that threat would logically be different from the one that women would choose. So, yeah, that is a phenomenon that's recently discovered and that's being researched, and it's kind of cool. Now, with regard to the heart attack, I won't go down the long, because there's a lot of stuff on that, but there's some interesting stuff about stress differences between men and women. Overall, and this doesn't matter whether you're a woman or a man, an interesting point about this whole fight, flight, and freeze phenomenon is that if you look at how that gets handled in the wild, what do? We fight or we run away, typically. And we're also involved in activities day in and day out where we're covering a lot of ground. We're off on the hunt, we're gathering, we're moving a lot in a primitive environment. And we also don't get triggered very often. We get triggered in primitive environments, interestingly enough, way less than we do in modern environments. So that physical movement is actually designed to clear all of that stuff out of our system. And because right now we're getting triggered all the time. Every time your phone rings, there's a little trigger that goes on. When you have to shift attention, there's a little trigger that happens. When you see something disturbing on television, there's a trigger that happens. So we're releasing these chemicals in our body on a constant basis in modern-day society, and we're not moving around and clearing them out. And there's a fair amount of evidence that's building up. It's not conclusive, but there's evidence that's building up that a lot of the health problems that we're experiencing is as a result of not clearing out the stress hormones and the stress neurotransmitters that are building up in our system. So it's not just that going out for a run helps us to lose weight, and that's what prevents the heart attack, but that we're actually clearing stress hormones out of our bodies. The other thing I'll say briefly about stress in women is that there's a phenomenon of adrenal burnout that's happening with women in today's society. And it comes from being forced into a system of working, and I won't say a lot about this, but that is designed around male physiology. And women actually have a duplicative male physiology. We can produce very similar neurotransmitters as a man can. And it makes sense in a primitive environment because if all the men in the village get killed and there's nobody to defend the village and go out on the hunt, it wouldn't make sense to have women that were there that couldn't get their own food, couldn't go on the hunt, couldn't defend themselves. So under times of severe stress, women can step into a very masculine mode of behavior. From a place of masculine neurotransmitters, we can up our production of testosterone. We can up our production of a lot of neurotransmitters that are more naturally in abundant supply for men. But what happens is it taxes our adrenal glands to do that. So you fast forward to women working in an environment that was set up by men. Well, how would they set up in a working environment? They'd set it up for their own neurotransmitters, right? It's not a phenomenon of anybody trying to be sexist. It's just you set up a system that works for you. And then women have come into that system. And because we have a duplicative biology, it's pretty easy to step into it until our adrenal glands start to burn out. So and this stuff is in the cusp of being studied as well right now. It's interesting new data that's coming out. And I think it's going to have some implications for how we structure work in the future.
Yes.
So anyway, that's probably more information that you needed there. But
thank you.
Thank you for the question.
I think, Janet, we have one more person.
Okay, great.
For the question.
They actually took their hand down. If anyone would like to ask a question, please press the letter Q or number 7 on your telephone keypad again. Kate Rivera. Please state your question. Kate, did you have a question?
Hello?
Kate, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. Oh, great. I just wanted to ask you a question, Janet, following up to the one you just answered, but could you be a little more specific about the ways in which the work environments are set up according to the male neurotransmitter systems?
I'll say one thing very briefly, and this is a really complex topic, and I want to make, just looking at time, I want to make sure that we, you know, we don't have a lot of time left on the call. And the main one is around focus,
okay.
That hyperfocus is driven by testosterone, so the ability to focus over long periods of time.
Oh.
And so one thing that women need to do is to put themselves in environments where they're allowed to defocus. And quite literally practices like dancing, like walking in nature, like taking breaks that allow a kind of a defocusing are very, very helpful in terms of female physiology for kind of resetting.
Okay. Just one quick question. Thank you. Those kinds of things would also be useful to men, maybe not as necessary, but also useful.
They may be, but from a biological standpoint, not as necessary.
Not as necessary, of course.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks so much.
Now, I am going to say something about the walking in nature, because this is where people may get confused. The prefrontal cortex stuff that I mentioned, as well as the amygdala, the idea is that you want to maximize the prefrontal cortex and minimize the amygdala. Well, people are going to trigger to the extent that they don't have quote-unquote emotional intelligence, where they haven't figured out their own triggering patterns and how to moderate them. But also, the less well we're taking care of our body systems, the higher the likelihood that we're going to trigger. And the things that maximize prefrontal cortex functioning are also the things that minimize amygdala activity and also maximize serotonin, which is the happiness neurotransmitter. So here's the things that figure into that: sunlight, meditation, a healthy diet, and that's kind of a caveman diet, you know, wild meat, nuts, fruits, vegetables, very simple diet, exercise, meaningful work, interestingly enough, and stable social connection. So those things in combination tend to produce a very powerful prefrontal cortex, one that functions well, and it also keeps the amygdala calm. The prefrontal cortex actually has a chemical called GABA that it can secrete, and when it's in good shape, the prefrontal cortex can actually secrete GABA when it determines that the amygdala needs to be calmed down, that actually safety does exist, and we'll just calm the amygdala down because this isn't a real threat. The prefrontal cortex actually is powerful enough to make that determination and soothe the amygdala. When the prefrontal cortex is not in good shape, it doesn't have the power to do that. So to the extent that your clients and your leaders and the people in your organizations are practicing those things, and by the way, I left one out, which is sleep, a huge factor for a lot of people. If we're trying to induce change in people and they don't have enough sleep, good luck. Because the brain, the parts of the brain that you need to have functioning in order to really engage in a change process aren't there. So one of the things that's very important in terms of working with individuals and organizations is, do they even have the biological basis to be able to make the changes that you're asking them to make?
Janet?
Yes.
I think there's another person with a question, but before we go there, I want to go back to something you were talking about a moment ago, having to do with the organization being set up to favor intense long-term focus, and how, you know, that's something that the male physiology, neurophysiology, is based on. And yet, I see in our organizations today, in particular, that is actually gone by the wayside. People don't, men and women don't have the ability to focus over long periods of time because everything is interrupt-driven constantly, which probably is, I'm guessing, setting up a lot of stress reaction in people.
Yes, it is. And actually, the kind of focus that I'm talking about is a kind of a rigorous planning focus that women need to be able to step out of, to be able to step out of a kind of a sequential controlling of the environment kind of thinking. So they need to be able to step out of that. The thing that's happening right now, though, which is disturbing, and it's fairly new in our history, and I think is having already a huge impact, is technology. 15 years ago, we didn't have the World Wide Web. I mean, think about that. We didn't have email. We didn't have access to the kind of information that we have now. And our brains are actually set up to not get very many key messages a day from people, to not see a lot of bright, shining objects and a lot of rapid movement and a lot of beeping sounds and all of that. And it's really designed to only have to track a few things. And when we talk about women being able to multifocus, we're not talking about being able to track, you know, hundreds of things within the course of an hour, which is what we're asking both men and women to do now. So we're asking both the male and the female brain, the human brain, to change from topic to topic to topic to topic with far greater frequency than it's designed to do. And what happens each time you change focus in the brain is that there's a net energy loss. It actually you have to disengage the neural systems that are warmed up. Here's a way to think about it. It's almost like you have to take those guys offline, cool them down, engage a whole nother neural circuitry, get that one warmed up and going, and then all of a sudden you get an email or you get something else, and now you have to power those ones down and boot up the new system. So neural networks in the brain actually compete with each other. We can't think about a variety of topics at the same time. Our brain is actually designed to go down one direction or another. And so when we ask the brain to change direction, it actually has to power down and power up again. Now, we do that so quickly that we don't consciously oftentimes notice that, but we do notice at the end of an hour, gee, I didn't get anything done, or I started down that pathway and then something got lost in between, or I was going to go get my glasses and I ended up in another room and I don't know why I was there. It's not Alzheimer's. It's that we're asking our brain to switch topics too many times, and at some point it just gets overloaded. It's a big concern about, and there is a huge, I believe, loss of effectiveness in organizations right now due to the way that we're using technology.
Yeah. Well, why don't we see if that other person with a question is still there, and if so, take that question.
Go ahead, ma'am.
Yes, and I'd also like to say that we have about 15 minutes left. There are a couple of interesting topics left as well, so I want to move through questions fairly efficiently if possible.
Okay, great.
Our next question is from Angela Wagner. Ma'am, did you have a question?
Hi, actually, it was the same follow-on question that the person before answered, so I retracted that question.
Okay, thank you.
Keep moving. Thanks.
Okay, so... Well, yeah, as you just mentioned, there's some many, many interesting topic areas. I think one of them might have to do with the sort of the whole notion of attraction, which is very popular in our culture right now or in our society.
Yeah, so kind of, I think the two topics that I'd love to hit, if we can squeeze them in, are both attraction and how change happens in the brain. Change is also a really big one for coaches, obviously. So with regard to the attraction piece, we're hearing all sorts of things about the law of attraction, the secret, et cetera, et cetera. And in reference to those neural networks that I talked about, whatever neural network is warmed up in your brain, we're designed to notice things in the environment that are congruent with the neural network that we have engaged. And so if I am walking around thinking about a particular topic, it's useful for my brain, out of all of the billions of things, thoughts that my brain could have, it's useful for me to have the thoughts that are congruent with whatever my predominant thought are warmed up and ready to go. That way I can think effectively about a topic. Otherwise, I just have a jumble of information in there. So the brain is very selective about getting stuff ready to be used. That's great for effective thinking, but let's think about if I'm walking around mad at a particular person. If I'm walking around angry at a particular person, I'm likely to notice I have all the circuits warmed up that have to do with anger at this person. And then I'm likely to notice the things in my environment that are congruent with the thoughts that I'm having. Because my attention, anything that I have my attention on, then calls my attention in the environment. It's the way that the brain has of parsing what information it takes in. Another example of this is that if I'm an interior designer and I'm sitting in a training somewhere in an organization, and I walk out of that training and you ask me what were the chairs like and what was the design on the carpet, I'm likely to be able to tell you, and that's because my profession is being an interior designer. So I always have part of my brain kind of cycling through noticing my environment. Now, if I'm not an interior designer, let's say I'm a software programmer, I'm sitting in that same room, it's very likely if I ask you what the design on the carpet was that I can't answer that question, because those aren't neural circuits that are even formed in my brain, let alone warmed up. So this whole notion that we attract experience is really as a result of what neural circuits do we have warmed up and available in our brain. To the extent that I'm thinking about I have a particular intention in my life, then I'm going to notice things or opportunities that are congruent with that intention. Now, does it mean that if I sit and I think about I want to be a rich person every morning, that I'll be a rich person? No. It's having neural circuits that are actually warmed up that are useful in drawing the things to me that I want to notice. And then I need to take action on those things in order to then further the chances that that's going to come into my life. So it's kind of a law of averages things. I'm going to notice the opportunities. I'm going to notice things that are congruent with the pathway that I want to have unfold for me in my life. Does it guarantee it? Absolutely not. Does it up the chances that I can get there? Yes. So it is very important that I pay attention to how I'm thinking and also what I'm putting in my environment, because every time I see a cue in my environment that warms up those neural circuitries, it reinforces my ability to notice and quote-unquote attract those experiences into my life. Likewise, every time I notice myself going down an old story that would be competitive with a new story, if I can stop myself and replace it with a new story, then again, I'm going to up the chances that I draw what I want into my life. And we've all experienced, you can just think of simple things, like about a year ago, I met a new guy and really liked him. And then the next day, and he had a blue car. I'd never seen that make of car before. And then the next day I'm on the freeway, I see a dozen of those cars on the freeway. You know, were there more of that particular blue Subaru on the car than on the freeway the next day? No. It's just that the neural circuits that I had warmed up were thinking about this guy, and everything related to him then was warmed up in my brain, and then my attention got directed to the things in my environment that were congruent with my thoughts. So that's the attraction phenomenon. Any questions about how that works or what it is? That's, by the way, in the literature called neural rings.
So that actually, it sounds like, has quite a bit of, it's directly related to the kind of work we do as coaches, in that we often are finding ourselves helping our clients redirect their attention towards what they do want as opposed to what they don't want, for example, whether it's an individual or a whole team of people. If their focus is constantly on what they don't want, that's what they see.
Exactly.
That's what
And focusing on how can they arrange their environment so that what they surround themselves with reinforces the patterning of noticing what they want and creating what they want in their life. So are they surrounding themselves with people who are doing the thing that they themselves want to be able to do? Are they surrounding themselves with people that have healthy emotional patterning that will allow them to create the kind of story in their life that will allow them to manifest what they want? Are they putting cues in their physical environment that reinforce a new story? And do they have a new story, which is a fundamental aspect of coaching, is helping them understand what the story is that's creating their reality and formulate a new story that will create a more functional reality. And then holding their focus on it, which is actually a great segue into the whole idea, the whole topic of change. Because what happens in the brain is that we have this kind of dynamic balance between trying to conserve all the patterns that we have in the brain. Because what we do is we learn things, and then we try to take them out of our conscious repertoire and put them into our unconscious repertoire. Because the brain actually has very, very little processor space that's in the conscious realm. Almost everything that happens in the brain is what's called implicit. It's kind of behind the black curtain. It happens without any conscious thought. So when you think about a baby waking up in the morning versus a fully formed adult waking up in the morning, the fully formed adult gets up, brushes their teeth, makes their bed, puts their makeup on or not, or shaves, and puts their socks on and their shoes on, and does a whole bunch of activities before they get out the door to go to work that are on autopilot. And yet a baby has to learn how to put that sock on, and it's actually a fairly rigorous process to get just to the point of putting a sock on, let alone a shoe. So the brain knows that once you've learned something and it works, whether it's an emotional pattern or a physical pattern, you want to put it on autopilot. And the things that have worked over time, if you're still alive, the brain codes those things as good patterns. Now, they may be actually obsolete patterns, but the brain doesn't get that at a neurological level. The interesting thing is the conscious level of the brain, the neocortex, can get that it's a dysfunctional pattern, and the rest of the brain does not get it. So this is why we have a diet industry and why it's so hard to change, because we get it at a logical level that we need to change, that we ought to do something different, and we've got the rest of the brain fighting to conserve the pattern that it thinks is keeping us alive.
This seems to have a huge implication for coaching.
Yes. So you've got... these patterns are stored in a place called the basal ganglia, and the prefrontal cortex goes, hey, I recognize there's something I want to change, and the prefrontal cortex says, not on your life, I'm not going to do it. So there's a little internal war that's going on between those two parts of the brain. In order for the prefrontal cortex to win, a couple of things has to happen. It has to be strong enough to calm the anxiety that's being produced in the rest of the brain. And it has to be able to replicate the new behavior consistently and often enough to create a new pattern. Because once you've taken something that's a habit and you've done it differently enough times, it becomes a new pattern. And it goes behind the black wall, again, behind the black curtain, and you now have replaced an older dysfunctional pattern with a newer, more functional pattern. The problem is that people get frustrated because they think that because they logically understand that they should change, that it's simply a moral failing that they haven't changed. You know, it's like, I tried and it didn't work. And the reality of the situation is that the prefrontal cortex has to override over and over and over again, and every time it does, it creates a moment of anxiety inside the brain, which feels very uncomfortable. The way the brain conserves the pattern is by creating anxiety so that you don't change. So this whole process, by the way, the impulse, taking in all the information from the environment, processing it, producing an impulse to do something, and doing it takes less than half a second. So the implications for coaching and change are that, first off, people need to be able to recognize that they're about to do something that they've committed to change. In other words, they have to recognize the old unwanted pattern. They have to have a commitment that they are going to change that pattern. They have to understand that they're going to feel uncomfortable when they make a new choice. They have to have a prefrontal cortex that's healthy enough to even do that. And then they have to have a new choice that's specific enough that they can take action on it within about 0.2 seconds, within that half a second. And if all that stuff isn't in place, it's very unlikely that someone's going to change. And then they have to do that enough times that they consolidate a new pattern. So you can see why changing is so difficult. But on the other hand, if people understand that that's the process that they're going to go through and that that's natural, and it's not a moral failing, it's just the way change happens, and they can arm themselves with enough knowledge around how they want to change and enough support in their system to reinforce it, then the likelihood that they change goes up. So that's a very quick rundown on change.
Yeah, a very quick rundown, and actually a very valuable one, because what you just said, I will often say pretty much the same way in about the same amount of time to my coaching clients, and it does give them the sort of the sense of, oh, it's not hopeless. I get it. I get what I need to do. And then I can reinforce that with them a few times during that time that they're working on changing. But just knowing, oh, okay, this is the system. This is the process that I have to work with helps.
Now, here's a part, the last thing that I'll say about this that's really pertinent to coaching. One thing that will really aid in change is if the client has their own aha around it. Because when people have an aha, there's this surge of dopamine, and dopamine is a chemical that helps the brain rewire itself. So to the extent that a coach can aid a client in having an aha about the way they want to change, then that client's brain is predisposed to do the rewiring. If the coach comes in and advises or tells the client, here's what I see that you need to do differently, or here's the solution for doing it differently, it doesn't help the client's brain release dopamine, which is what's needed for that client's brain to do the changing. So academically, it's great. You have a solution on the table. But in terms of implementing the solution, you haven't helped the other person's brain do it. So that, you know, one of the fundamental tenets of coaching is that you don't give the solution, but that you're a thought partner in helping the other person derive their solution. And it's really key from a brain chemistry standpoint.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the most important things for us as coaches to remember, especially when we find ourselves tempted to, oh, I know what you need to do. So...
Yeah, it feels good for us because when we solve their problem, we get the dopamine
right release.
Yeah. We don't understand why it doesn't feel good to them, you know.
And we're getting paid to have this nice dopamine release in our own minds.
Exactly.
But it ultimately doesn't serve.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's looking like we're very close to the end, and there's we've covered a lot of territory. I just wanted to kind of go back and reiterate a couple of the things that I think you said that really struck me as valuable. One is the whole notion of having that healthy prefrontal cortex and the things that people can do, our clients can do, to help ensure they have a healthy prefrontal cortex. Because I guess one of the things that often I find is that we're fighting an uphill battle if mm-hmm. the person's overtired, you know, that they don't have a crummy diet and so on. So could you just run down that list of things that help ensure a healthy?
Yeah, I've dubbed them the serotonin seven because the same things that produce serotonin are also helpful for the prefrontal cortex. They are sleep, exercise, healthy diet, meaningful social connect or meaningful work, stable social connection, and meditation.
Yeah, good stuff. Anything? What else do you think? We literally have 1 minute, and anything else that you think we should mention or you want to mention here at this point as a closing with this?
I think the thing that I would mention is that, you know, while this stuff can seem very kind of hardcore, scientific, non-humanistic, the interesting thing that I found is that with many of my clients who are business people and scientists and engineers, and certainly for myself, that this information has given me tremendous respect for myself and also compassion and empathy for myself and for other people. Because when I get a response and a trigger from someone else, I get where that's coming from. I'm getting the patterning that's producing the response. When I'm not able to change as rapidly as I would want to change, you know, I get from a biological standpoint and respect why my body is fighting making that change. I'm also respectful of the need to take care of my body so that I can have the kind of brain to produce the work that I want to do in the world. So it's really given me a compassion and respect and a love for human biology that's quite profound and I think quite useful for a lot of my clients who tend to live out of their bodies and in their heads.
Yeah. And so there's two sides to that. One is, as coaches, we need to keep ourselves well-tuned as an instrument. And then it also, like you say, it can give us a real sense of compassion for the people around us who are trying to change, who want to change, and are finding it frustrating, difficult.
Yeah. And you mentioned a key thing, which I think may be a great way of wrapping things up, which is a topic that we didn't go into is limbic resonance and limbic revision. But our emotional systems actually will pattern around the emotional systems of the people that are around us. So as coaches, it's really important for us to pay attention to what our own emotional soup is, how we're handling our own emotions and our own lives, our own prefrontal cortex health, et cetera, because we have a powerful influence on our clients. And one of the most powerful influences is that there's actually a nonverbal patterning that happens when we're in the presence of somebody who's healthy. So just showing up to a coaching session in good shape is already doing good coaching for your clients.
Well, okay. Well, thank you, Janet, very much. We're at the end of our time.
Listening to this development call for coaches, consultants, and other organizational practitioners. For more information about our executive coaching and leadership development services, or to obtain other podcasts in the Conversations with Masters series, please contact us at www.integralcoaches.com or at mobiusleadership.com.